This episode of Life and Books and Everything is brought to you by Crossway, publisher of New Morning Mercies, a daily gospel devotional from Paul David Tripp. Many of you may be familiar with this best-selling book. I have it. I've used it. My family has used it. Lots of Christians have used it. And the right devotional really makes a big difference. And many Christians have this as a part of their practice. And I think part of what has made Tripp's work so useful is it just gets that right balance of gospel encouragement, biblical focus. There's enough there that you can sink your teeth into. It's not, you know, just a story about somebody's puppy. It's got good gospel meat to it, and it's a good way to start out your day. This devotional equips readers with the good news that we need at the start of every day to trust in God's goodness, live for His glory day in and day out. Pick up a copy of New Morning Mercies wherever books are sold, or visit crossway.org/newmorningdevotional to learn how you can get a 30% off with a free Crossway Plus account. We also want to thank our friends at Desiring God for supporting the podcast. This is an important question to ask yourself. Can I really know God if I don't know what makes Him happy? What pleases God? We know the Shorter Catechism says the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. That's our enjoyment. What about the pleasures of God? There are some dozen places in the New Testament talks about what pleases God. So how can we know what pleases God and what it means for us to live a life that is pleasing to Him? DG is releasing a brand new revised edition of John Piper's book, The Pleasures of God. You may have read Desiring God, that classic work, and this is a really important part of what Piper has been trying to teach in his life of ministry, The Pleasures of God. This foundational book, John navigates the biblical evidence to help us see and savor what the pleasures of God show us about Him so that we might become like the one that we behold. Perhaps you've read Desiring God, but not this one. Now is your chance to read The Pleasures of God, or if you want to re-explore the truths in this book, it may be a long time since you looked at it. You can pre-order a copy today at crossway.org. Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Life and Books and Everything. I'm Kevin DeYoung, senior pastor at Christ Covenant Church here in Matthews, North Carolina, right next to Charlotte. I also teach at Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte. And I am very glad to be joined by our special guest, Jan Van Vliet. That sounds like a good Dutch name.
It is, sir. Born in
there. Yes. And I want to, we're just meeting, but I've read this book. I got it when it first came out in 2024. We're going to be talking about Jan's book on Adam Smith in the PNR Great Thinkers series. There's many of these. I'm not quite sure. I have four or five of them on my shelf, but it's a good series. And it goes through these great thinkers. It's in under 150 pages and explains their thought by somebody who's an expert in the field and then gives a Christian examination of their ideas. And so Jan has done a really nice job with Adam Smith. And one of the reasons for talking about Adam Smith, there's a lot of focus here in the States on 1776, the Declaration, 250th anniversary, and I am all in on reading lots of things to do with the American founding. But another important 1776 date is the date that The Wealth of Nations was published. Very influential book authored by Adam Smith, and we're going to talk about that. I would love first, Jan, give us your teaching at Dort, or you've been teaching at Dort. Give us a little history of your background, your education, your interest in this subject, and the sort of intellectual pursuits you've had.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. So I came to Adam Smith via rather interesting circumstances. We emigrated to Toronto. I was five from The Hague, from the Netherlands. and I was schooled there and so forth. My father was a financial consultant, and he thought that I would take over the business. So I did high school. I happened to drop out of high school. So you're actually talking to a high school dropout. My gap year was 4 years.
Okay.
So I dropped out at 16. I was in grade 12, back at 20. And I happened to come into, in grade 13, we still had grade 13 in those days. I walked into my history class and I had a history teacher who happened to be, as it turns out now, a Marxist or a really good pretender. And so our textbook for the American economy was We the People, but it had a real Marxist take to it.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so I took that. I found it really interesting for my senior project. I asked if I could review Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which had come out in a 1970 Penguin edition paperback. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and a number of other things happened. I went to university and once finished high school. And in those 4 years that I was out of university, I read some. I also was a mechanic, an automotive mechanic. So, you know, a number of things. In university, though, I majored in business. I could never keep my debits and credits straight, and I did not like accounting. With respect to all the accountants who might be listening and who I have taught, their economics anyways. So I switched into economics first year. It just required, I thought, it. The deeper thinking of economics interested me. Mm-hmm. And there was many different directions I could go. So I fast-forwarded through my undergraduate, did a graduate degree in Queen's University, Canada. And then I went into a career in the investment community, consulting community on Bay Street, which is the Toronto counterpart to New York's Wall Street. Mm-hmm. So then, and I did that for a few years. I taught economics at the University of Toronto. And then I was economic advisor to the Minister of Finance in Northern Canada. And then I, at the same time, when I was in Toronto, I took my first degree in theology. And that made a real impact on me. A couple of teachers there who, interestingly, had both been trained at Westminster Seminary and the Free University. And so, well, back, I go to Yellowknife, Canada. The family goes up there. We do some economic consulting and advising to the finance minister. Then we move to Philadelphia. I get my the itch to do a PhD in theology. I go to Westminster. And we're there for 8 years. In those 8 years, I did the degree, and then I taught there as well for about a year because we had issues with the health of one of our professors. And so after that, we came back to Canada, and I taught theology at Prairie College in Three Hills, Alberta, for 8 years, did a sabbatical year at Denver Seminary, taught a little there, wrote my first book. On a Puritan, William Ames, and then came to Dort because my job disappeared in Canada due to falling enrollment. Dort was open, and then I found this wonderful haven where I could put together both my my theological training, my training in economics, and my practical work. Also, students love it when you can tell them the practical application of the discipline you're teaching them. Right? It rings true a little bit more than just the academic textbook. So did that. And it was also through Dort, I had heard of Abraham Kuyper, that I also became very familiar with Kuyper. And so I remember I said a couple of times in my classes when I came to Dort, before I came to Dort, I thought Calvin was the fourth member of the Trinity. I now realize it's Abraham Kuyper. And so I got involved in the translation committee. Kuyper had I had a contribution to a 12 or so volume called Abraham Kuyper's Public Theology, and I did the volume on Islam, his views.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, very, very interesting study. And then I heard about the P&R Great Thinker series. I sent them a request to see, are they interested in, you know, not the the Aquinas, and are they interested in a political philosopher, a moral theorist? And that's when I started with Adam Smith. I signed the contract in 2018, and then COVID hit in the my research. And the pivoting, my new favorite word, right? Pivoting. and that put me back quite a bit. I mean, Dort was very generous in giving me course release and so forth, and opportunities to, I did chapters. I spoke on those chapters in various places. But yeah, then I retired and I finished the book.
Oh, that's great. Did you grow up in the Dutch Reformed Church? Yeah. You grew up a Christian.
Yes, we grew up in a small Dutch Reformed Church in Toronto.
So okay.
We commuted every Sunday from Whitby, Ontario.
Christian Reformed Church or Christian Reformed or a Canadian denomination?
Netherlands Reformed.
Netherlands Reformed. Okay. Yeah. Straight up, the real deal. I grew up in the RCA, which, you know, was had some good and some bad, but
I learned
you may or may not know, I know we have some mutual friends and I know some folks at Dort, but my first church, I was an associate pastor in Orange City, just down the road from you. So your rival denominationally, the two cities separated by 6 mile squares in either direction to get up from Orange City to Sioux Center, all the different places you've been in. I mean, Sioux Center's not Toronto. How have you liked living in Iowa?
Nor is it Philadelphia, where I was 8 years. You know, God prepared us for Iowa and for the Midwest here in the U.S. by having us in Three Hills, Alberta, for 7 years, 8 years.
It's not many places you can move from there to Sioux Center, Iowa, and be moving far south.
That's right. Yeah.
But you found one. Who was there at, and we'll get to the book in just a moment, who was there at Westminster when you were there? Who were you studying with?
Historical theology, Sinclair Ferguson.
Oh, good.
Interestingly, I bought Dick Gaffin's house. He was teaching theology as well, and he was just moving out of his house into, and in fact, interesting byline here is that the house had an addition built to it to house the widow of E.J. Young. And E.J. Young was a big name at in Toronto at Tyndale Seminary, where I was, because the Old Testament professor was taught by E.J. Young. Very interesting. Will Barker, my advisor. Wonderful. All wonderful men. Claire Davis, who was brilliant in the way he communicated incredibly complex topics and reduced them like to a kernel that was accessible to the student. I learned a whole, and he sat on his desk and just talked, right? I learned my own shorthand and took all his notes. Wow. I made notes in everything he said. So church history, historical theology, apologetics, of course, with Scott Oliphant, who I think recently retired. And then Sinclair Ferguson. And then that's Peter Lilback, who is, I think, in his last year as president.
He's now Dave Garner will be president.
I graduated. Those are good guys. I graduated with Dave Garner.
Okay, good. Well, we know a lot of the same people.
Yeah.
So my interest in Adam Smith, you're the expert, I'm not, but my interest in Adam Smith, I did my PhD on John Witherspoon. And so, you know, I was looking mostly at his pastoral career, but he's probably most well known for his lectures on moral philosophy, which he gave at Princeton. And when he was in Scotland, he immigrated to the United States in 1768, but he was born the same year as Adam Smith, 1723. In fact, in 2023, they were having a conference in Scotland on Adam Smith and John Witherspoon. And I forget the other person who was born 1723. And I really wanted to make it, but I just couldn't fit in my schedule another trip across the pond. But because Scotland, I mean, it's relatively small now. It was even smaller then, just a country with lots of small little cities, and especially in and around Edinburgh. You know, all of these men would have known of each other and probably knew each other.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of intersections with Adam Smith. And of course, everyone is by default a part of the Church of Scotland. So in studying Witherspoon led me into some of Adam Smith. I've taught a class a couple of times here at RTS, an elective class on the history of the Enlightenment. So I have a couple of lectures on Adam Smith. So I'm always interested when there's another Christian who's has some interest and has done some fine work like you have. Yeah. Why don't we start here? Just give us a little bit, just a basic biographical sketch. In sure. some ways, his biography is not terribly fascinating. He stayed mostly, you know, in and around some of the same places, but there's some important moves here and there. So just give us Adam Smith, where he was, when he lived, what he did.
Right. Born in 1723 to a very Calvinist and pious mother. His father, I think he was born just after or just before his father died, left him a large library. Of course, a lot of Calvinist philosophy or Calvinism theology in there as well. So he was raised in Kirkcaldry. He had ties with his mother that were never broken. He ended up living 10 years of his life, near the end of his life, writing Wealth of Nations with his mother back in Kirkcaldry after all of his travels. Kirkcaldry is basically across the Bay of Forth, the first Forth from Edinburgh, right? So that's where we're talking now, sort of eastern Scotland up there. There was also a pin factory there, and I'll come back to that later.
Famous illustration in the Wealth of Nations.
Yeah. So he was expected to go into the ministry. He learned the catechism at his mother's knee, so to speak. And then he went with a scholarship. He went to Glasgow at the age of 14. He had learned the classics at school and so forth. And he came under the teaching of Francis Hutcheson. And that turned out to be the greatest influence with David Hume upon his life and his thinking. It looks like he probably was more influenced by Hutcheson in his thinking than by his mother, at least in the religion, if that's what we can call it, that it appears he ended up leaning to and into and with and ultimately siding with. But he learned a lot, as I said, from Hutcheson. And he took notes, and a lot of the notes that he had from Hutcheson, he himself used when he taught moral theology in Glasgow. And then even the moral theology that he was teaching ended up finding its way, much of it, into his Wealth of Nations. So you see, the sort of, you know, before the Enlightenment, the real political economy was very... it was normative, and it was it was moral, right? And I'll come back to that later. And sort of that's the aura, that's the world in which he lived and which he inhabited. From Glasgow to Edinburgh, did some traveling in Europe with the nephew, I believe, of Townsend, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, or the Minister of Finance, Secretary of Treasury, whatever you want to call it. And then on a very healthy pension. And then he came back to Scotland. And there's more detail there. But essentially, as I said, lived with his mother and wrote much of Wealth of Nations there. In 1759, he had written Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is his first. So I'm working with his moral philosophy or his social philosophy. He's been called many things. He's been called the father of sociology. So I'm working with both that and his Wealth of Nations, his political economy. And, you know, one of my desiderata here is to show the connection between the two. And I hope I've succeeded in that. To Smith, his moral philosophy was much more important. The final edition, the sixth edition in 1790, came out just before he died. And so there's some significant differences in that from the earlier editions. So he was always thinking about moral philosophy. But of course, you know, jurisprudence, right? That's what he wanted to do, encompassed all of this. So in a sense, scholars say that this magna opera, as I call it, these two volumes are really incomplete because he didn't really finish everything he wanted to say about law and government, all of jurisprudence, right?
Right. Yeah. The moral philosophy is such an important category. I think it's unfortunate. It's not one that we tend to use today, but you know, from really the middle part of the 16th century, maybe, you know, Hugo Grotius is the first Protestant natural law. You can tell me how to really say his, you know, his name.
Oh, Grotius, yeah.
With a good, yeah, with a good Dutch pronunciation. But, you know, Puffendorf, who's a Lutheran and German, but Hutcheson to Adam Smith, even Witherspoon lectures, and in the colonies, it's the capstone seminar, and was usually taught by the president. So this was the big deal, sort of putting it your whole university education. And this is, you know, influenced by the Scottish Enlightenment for sure.
Yeah.
Is this course on moral philosophy. And as you said, the word moral is important. There's an oughtness to this, and it's kind of a catch-all for jurisprudence, economics, national, international relations, human behavior, sort of what can we learn about how we should relate to each other as people, as nations, from natural law, from reason. And depending on the person, they might not be very interested in revelation, or if they're Orthodox, they may just say, well, this comports with revelation, but we're doing something here. This is not exegetical theology or systematic theology. This is natural theology. Why was this moral philosophy category so important in the 18th century? And this is going a little bit into the 19th century, but what happened that it really seemed to fall out of favor? These are all topics that are still talked about, of course, but as a unifying whole, it sort of fades out in the second half of the 19th century.
Yeah, I think it goes back to something that you said, and Smith said himself very early on, that the last work in jurisprudence, which encompasses all these areas, was Dutchman Hugo Grotius. And so it's my intention now to do a comprehensive project on this, which he then did not end up doing. I think a lot of it had to do, if you think of Abraham Kuyper, with the Enlightenment, and the French Revolution, right, which played out in 1789. You know, you mentioned 1776 for Wealth of Nations. You mentioned 1776 for the U.S., 1779 French Revolution, 1770s Industrial Revolution. Everybody's in the world is in turmoil. We're at the end of the early modern age, right? Mm-hmm. Late 18th century modernism. A lot has to do with the loss of morality. A lot of that has to do with the mantra of the storming of the Bastille, and then ni Dieu ni maître, no God, no master, right? And then secularism stepped in. And that sort of took over, I think, all of the thinking on jurisprudence and moral philosophy as well, kind of became kind of lost moral philosophy.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask a question before we get to these two major works, just another biographical question. We can come back to how a Christian might evaluate Smith's philosophy, But just talk about Smith as a person. He dies in 1790, and you say in the book, you know, there's just a lot of things we can't know about his own personal faith. But what we know is there's not a lot to be super encouraged about. But how do you size up? What was his religious commitment? What was his faith? What can we know about him as a Christian or not?
Right. And here is the undisclosed chapter of the book. I did a chapter on exactly that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so when I sent the book to the editor, it was too long by, I think, 30%. It did not fit that nice 150-page summary, right? And so then I remember I was at my daughter's in Jacksonville, North Carolina, where she lived at the time with her family. And I was trying to figure out, how am I going to lose so many thousands of words? And I took the chapter on his, it's called Adam Smith, Social, Imaginary, and Religion. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, here it is right here. So I took the chapter out, did some more editing, took a large piece out on free market applied to the church. Interesting.
Yeah.
And then the book, a little bit of further editing, and the book was good to go. But it's in that, and that I have that now in the June 2025 issue of Pro. Is an article on Adam Smith, his social, imaginary, and religion.
Oh, that's good. So give us, what's the thumbnail sketch? What did you conclude?
The thumbnail sketch is essentially that he was very much like Benjamin Franklin. And, you know, Benjamin Franklin was a deist. He was a product, of course, of the Presbyterianism of the day, just as Francis Hutcheson was. A real commitment to providentialism, the providential nature of God, but sort of the Paley philosophy of the creation of the world. God wound the clock up and then kind of walked away, although it's still very providential. I'm not exactly sure how to bring those two together properly. And Adam Smith knew Benjamin Franklin. So the way he's raised, coming under the teaching of Francis Hutcheson, deist, very liberal Presbyterianism. His students say that, okay, he signed the Westminster Confession. He had to teach at Glasgow. But then his students say his prayers were simply prayers of natural theology. Mm-hmm. And then he left. So I think if you take his faith or his religion and take it to the end, he does believe in a greater power. If you look again at his moral philosophy, in the end, if your conscience doesn't judge you, if the impartial spectator can't judge you, there is somebody who will judge you, and that's the God of nature. That's the deity in whose image we are created. How orthodox is that?
Right.
There it is. Right. There it is. Right near the end of his book. Right. So his moral philosophy. There it is. So as I say in this article, clearly deist, clearly stoic, huge stoic after Marcus Aurelius, the second century Roman philosopher and
a lot of people miss how influential he was in the Scottish Enlightenment and Lord Shaftesbury, and they were they really liked
that whole
Marcus
group,
Aurelius.
That whole group. Yeah, the key to good living is self-command. That's a Stoic doctrine. And we can talk a little bit about that later if we have time. Stoicism, deism, and then a sprinkling, I say in this chapter, in the journal, a sprinkling of Orthodox Calvinism.
Yeah.
You know, I think Scotland went Calvinist by 1560. That's kind of the demarcation. You know, Knoxian Calvinism, and many people, they were not attracted to that. The iconoclast, that sort of extreme form expression, I think that's what makes Knox really interesting. But anyways, so 1560, go to 1759, theory of moral sentiments, you know, 199 years later, you get, right? And then Wealth of Nations comes after that.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting track.
It is. One of the lines here, Smith, so David Hume, his good friend, and David Hume was much more infamous for his infidelity. I don't mean sexual infidelity, but his religious infidelity than Smith was. But there are a lot of people like Smith too, and you've described him well. But Smith and Hume were friends. And in 1776, when Hume died, Smith publishes a letter extolling Hume's courage and his fortitude. And many Christians were praying for a deathbed conversion. And so they were very unhappy when Smith wrote this letter, really, oh, what a manly fortitude he had at death. And then this line, Smith later wrote in 1780, that the letter commending Hume, quote, brought me 10 times more abuse than the very violent attack I had made upon the whole commercial system of Great Britain.
He talks about the serenity with which Hume died, and he compared that to the whining of the Christian when they died.
Yes.
I mean, it's hilarious. The pushback he got, and I mean, he gave as good as he got.
He did. And to say that, you know, I got more flack for that letter than trying to tear down the whole economic system that existed in Great Britain.
Which he did.
Well, we want, So I want to talk about these two works, and you've alluded to this, and I know you encounter this in the literature. So when I did my Witherspoon research, people would sometimes talk about Das Witherspoon problem, which was, did Witherspoon, are there two Witherspoons, one on when he's in Scotland and is a foe of the Enlightenment, it seems, and then one in America where he seems to teach the Enlightenment philosophy in his class. And part of my dissertation was to argue there aren't two Witherspoons, but that Das Witherspoon problem comes from, in the German literature, in the reception of Smith, the Das Adam Smith problem. Explain to us, what is that problem? Because it relates exactly to the two parts of your book where you look at these two major Adam Smith pieces of literature.
It has to do with the use of the concept of self-interest. So if I can just read how he opens his theory of moral sentiments, just no matter how selfish you think man is, it's obvious that there are some principles in his nature that give him an interest in the welfare of others and make their happiness necessary to him, even if he gets nothing but the pleasure of seeing it, right? So what we need to do is conceive or imagine being in pain or distress that arouses in us, the observer, some degree of emotion. Our fellow feeling, a phrase that comes up all the time, for the misery of others comes from our imaginatively changing places with the sufferer. So his view in his moral philosophy, in his social philosophy of self-interest, is that we are happiest. Part of our happiness is that our neighbors are happy, right? So now you go to his moral, to his political economy, and their self-interest seems to take on a different tone. We pursue everything in our own self-interest. We maximize our own well-being. And in the extreme, which is something that John Stuart Mill came upon or developed, we are homo economicus. We are economic man. We are interested only in utility maximization, in, you know, padding our own pockets, the heck with everybody else. We are only interested in ourselves. Self-interest. So scholars have played with this. Some are happy to say, you know, and I think I won't mention any names. Great scholars. But I'm not sure if that's accurate, that there are different definitions of self-interest. Mm-hmm. I think we need to take to resolve the Adam Smith problem, we need to go back to his what he called his most beloved work, his Moral Philosophy. To him, it was the much greater work, the much more important work, and take him at his point of departure. And that's where everything starts. Okay.
Yeah.
So now we go into the weeds of his political economy. And the Adam Smith, there are no two Adam Smiths or two Witherspoons or the earlier and the later Bart here. There's none of that. But this guy is consistent. You know, we have two realms of experience. We have the moral realm, right? Where happiness and human flourishing is seen in a moral society. And secondly, in the economic realm, in the material realm, we see material flourishing, and you know, self-interest. Yeah, and then he says, you know, the great command of Christianity is, you know, love your neighbor as you love yourself. And then he says, how is that different from loving yourself as you love your neighbor? You see, he turns that phrase around. So the one is, I'm going to say, foundational, and Smith's take, I think, is an apologetic for his sort of phenomenological take on human behavior and on the moral code and on establishing morality, because what he wants to do is have a perfect society made up of virtuous people who subscribe to the cardinal virtues, the chief one of which is self-command, and that's Stoic.
Right.
Self-interest, but yeah.
Yeah. I really like the way you put that, and glad that you said, and I knew you would from the reading the book, but glad you said there aren't two Adam Smiths. Of course, humans change and our ideas develop, but you're absolutely right. That they're not mutually contradictory, these two works. They deal with a vocabulary that needs to be looked at very carefully. So the Theory of Moral Sentiments, first published 1759, and then revised several times. Talk to us a little bit about what he means by some of these key terms. One of the things that I see in our day, and I'm sort of tilting against windmills to change any of this, but we tend to use a lot of terms as synonyms that in earlier centuries were very particular terms. So we say emotion and affection, and we mean the same thing. They did not, in fact, I have a book on how the Scots invented emotion, which is a strange thing to say the Scots invented, but that it's a late 18th century, early 19th century, even the word emotion. So we say affections, passions, emotions, sympathy, sentiment, and we kind of just all mean something similar, just what you feel.
Yeah.
But for 18th century moral philosophy, first of all, most of them aren't saying emotion. They're saying motions, like an affection is a motion of the will. But these are all particular terms. So for Adam Smith, it's called Theory of Moral Sentiments. What did he mean by a sentiment? And then, because sympathy is not identical to sentiment, but sympathy is the key to his philosophy of moral sentiments. So start there. What did he mean by sentiment and by sympathy?
Basically sympathy. And sympathy in the 17th, in the 18th century meant what we mean by empathy today. Okay. So the heart of his book is exercising your empathetic drive as you view the morality and the behavior of those around you, and as you view your own behavior and morality. So yeah, you're right, Kevin, there is a whole scholarship. What did he mean by sentiments? What are those exactly? Sympathy understood then as we understand empathy today.
So yeah, sympathy is not so much pity, how we might use the word. He's not saying, oh, you just go around and I feel, oh, I'm so sorry for you.
Yeah.
It would it be similar to our adage of walking a mile in someone else's shoes, sort of putting ourselves in their.
I have used that myself. I think in a way that's the best description, but now it gets a little bit more complicated because when you're talking about empathy, we're talking about emotions. Mm-hmm. You're empathetic to a person's the wax and wane of their emotions. And you know, his whole construct of the impartial spectator works with that. But in order for that to work, and they are empiricists, Hume, Smith, Hutchison, very phenomenological, very empirical. Reality is based not on reason, but on your observations of lived reality. And so he says, you need to exercise your empathy, but part of that is the exercise of your imagination to get into that other person's shoes. Hmm. Let me give you an example. When East Vancouver comes to mind for me. So you look at what's happening on the streets of the East End of Vancouver, and there's other cities. I've seen it in Philadelphia as well. And you think, wow, that is so sad. Whether it's sex trade or drugs, huge drugs, mm-hmm. often the two go together, or you know other things that we would consider strongly immoral. And so Smith says, yeah, it's good that we get into that we're empathetic to their condition, but what's more is we need to really walk in their shoes. We need to get into their lived reality. And in order to do that, you have to exercise your faculty of reason. And you do that through the use of imagination. The imagination is so huge in this book because the imagination, as Charles Griswold, a great Smith scholar, said, it jumps that epistemic gap from, okay, I feel sorry for you, I'm so sad for you, I feel you, to, wow, I now really get what you're going through. I now really get, as I imagine myself on the streets, doing these, engage in this immoral kind of life, which is no good for anybody. So, yeah,
right.
It's moral, the sentiments, again, it's a great question.
Yeah, and so this Witherspoon problem, and you've articulated it well, is trying to understand, we'll come to Wealth of Nations. It seems that he has a very pessimistic view of human nature. We're self-interested creatures. Here, people say, well, he doesn't have a very rosy view. He just thinks that we're always looking with sympathy upon our fellow creatures and we're very sociable. And maybe this is downstream from Francis Hutcheson's moral sense, which is not quite conscience, but it's related to conscience. And yet, Smith, yeah, he's not quite the Calvinist we would want him to be, but he doesn't think that we just automatically always do the right thing, or we always come to the right conclusion, or sympathy or empathy, as you're using it. It doesn't mean for Adam Smith that you just put yourself in someone else's shoes and then you suspend any faculty of judgment upon those activities. What does he do then? What does sympathy enable us to do? Because it doesn't mean for Smith that we become moral relativists.
In the end, the system he builds is exactly relativistic.
Okay, so yeah, help me see that.
He's very anti-foundational. It's sort of anthropologically focused. The Christian theist view is theocentric. So he does understand, though, and is that his old Scottish or his old Calvinist stuff coming to the surface? We call it original sin. He understands that the impartial spectator, he understands that our judgment of ourselves and of each other is not perfect. Why? Because we don't exercise sufficient self-command over our passions, right? We need to, you know, it's the inner struggle between our passions and the flowing of society, whether it's the commercial flowing or just the relationships we have. And so he says, now we need to judge. How good are we at judging? Well, number one, we are the impartial spectator is pretty good at it, but not perfect, because what we would call the noetic effects of sin, right? Adam Smith, you don't understand things perfectly, right? Secondly, if we fail, then our conscience, there's our conscience. It works, but we don't have a right read on our conscience either, or we make mistakes, so we don't judge correctly. So what's our ultimate judge? You know, the ultimate arbiter, the ultimate adjudicator. It's the God of nature, right? In the end, then you will be judged by the God of nature. And he says, if you are religious, that should come as great, great comfort to you, mm-hmm. right? Because you have all these layers of assessment of your morality. Remember, the idea is to create a perfectly moral, virtuous society, right? In which we then do our commercial and our economic work. So in the end, God will judge you. The author of nature will judge.
So if God judges, so I want to just see if we're on the same page here. I think what you're saying, Jan, is that because he rejects, you know, the foundations of biblical revelation, he doesn't do it explicitly, but the system he's building is not built upon that foundation. It lends itself in the end to a kind of moral relativism. I think what I also hear you saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth, is he himself is not teaching live however you want, anything goes, whatever you do. He wants this to land on a moral code. So I would argue that, and I think this is one of the chief weaknesses, and I do believe it in a place for natural theology, but I think one of the weaknesses with a lot of it in the 18th century is there's so much still infused with a basic Christian way of viewing the world that it's like they've climbed up the ladder of Christian revelation and they're here. And now they say, look, we can have all of this by reason and sense and sensibility and sympathy. We can get there. And you know what? For their generation, maybe they still kind of could, because there's enough residual Christian impulse. But the system itself isn't ultimately going to lead you there. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but is that fair to how you're critiquing Smith?
I think so. He uses the cardinal virtues, right? Mm-hmm. Those are his sort of, that's the standard bearers for virtue, is the four cardinal virtues. And then he reduces it to prudence, benevolence, and justice. And all three are huge. Prudence transfers into the frugality of his Wealth of Nations. And there's a lot on that in Wealth of Nations, how you should spend and how you should save. If you don't save, there's no money for investment. The magic to an increased economy is capital expansion, which is done through your savings. So you need to be frugal, which is prudent, right? So there's that transfer. There's the disappearance of that aspect of the ASB, the Adam Smith problem. The standard is for him prudence, benevolence, and justice with a healthy dose, very strong dose of self-command, an umbrella over everything.
Yeah, self-command's important term.
And it's with not enough of self-command that we fail in our judgments of ourselves and others.
Right. So make sure we have some time here then to talk about the other half of the equation, which is the more famous work, at least to most Americans, The Wealth of Nations, first released in March, I think you said, of 1776.
Right.
Massive, big book. And here, famous for saying that self-interest is often the key to economic prosperity. The famous quotation, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. We address ourselves to their humanity, but to their self-love," or not to their humanity, but to their self-love, "and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantages. So what did Smith mean here by self-interest, and how does it function now in this economic system?
I'm going to say that the common perception today would be that of the Homo economicus. I mean, I think that's the economy that we have today, and that's kind of how I wrap up the book, that we are entirely utilitarian, that we want to raise our own wealth, our own stature. And that's where that has led. But I don't think that is authentic Adam Smith. Mm-hmm. I think the self-interest, I still hang on to the way he defined it in Theory of Moral Sentiments, even though it, you know, and again, it's a huge body of literature, Kevin, right? You're hitting the pulses of the difficulties of this, which is why it's also such an interesting study. But in the end,
Yeah. How would you see the self-interest? Is it, this may be one way to ask the question. I think a lot of people hear that and they think of the, you know, Gordon Gekko quote, greed is good. And that's what capitalism is, just a system that says greed is good.
Yeah.
I would argue there's certainly, you know, there's greed in every human system because there's greed in the human heart. I don't think Adam Smith equates self-interest necessarily with greed. It's a broader category. So what is he insisting upon when he says you can really pursue your self-interest and have it be beneficial for the corporate good?
Right. And so it can be nothing other than the fact that if we're looking at a beautiful, virtuous society, that I pursue my self-interest. My self-interest carried over from Theory of Moral Sentiments into Wealth of Nations. It includes taking care of my fellow man or woman, which raises the bar, raises the level of the flourishing, if you want to use that word, of the society I'm trying to construct. That's the way I see it, right? Mm-hmm. That self-interest. I guess you could say, and I've heard this many times too, that, you know, one of the unintended consequences of self-interest is that the rising level lifts all boats, right? Rising water lifts all boats. Mm-hmm. And I find that a little platitudinous, particularly coming from Christians, because I find it an excuse to pursue self-interest in that singular way, that we're going to contribute to GDP. But, you know, in a sense, Adam Smith did mean that. The thing is, not all boats are the same, right? Some boats are bad boats. They leak. And we can talk about what Adam Smith said about education, to continue that metaphor, to fix that.
Yeah, I think that the education is really important, because you point this out in the book that, yes, Adam Smith, you can describe him as the father of modern capitalism in some ways. He does use the term invisible hand. He does not use the term laissez-faire, and you talk about that at some length. Is that really a good summary of Adam Smith's? And probably not the best term, although he you know, studied and was familiar with these physiocrats from France, where laissez-faire comes from. But he does have this idea of an invisible hand, meaning, you know, I think it was his contemporary William Godwin who said, all right, you can plot out sort of intentional and unintentional and harmful and beneficial actions. If you do something intentional and it's beneficial, that's virtue. If you do something intentional and harmful, that's vice. If you do something unintentional and harmful, that's negligence. And in some ways, then you have Smith who's saying, you can do something unintentional and have it be beneficial. And I think that is an insight from Smith. You can be pursuing, he doesn't mean self-interest necessarily your greed and your avarice. Your self-interest may be you want your family to eat, or you want to pursue a religious life, or you want to pursue sculpture. So he says that when we pursue that sort of self-interest, it is possible, as with an invisible hand, that others are benefiting. But here's where I want you to talk about education and come back to your statement about the pin making. He does realize that it is possible in this kind of system to have such a life of drudgery, just the worst kind of stereotype of a mindless automaton human being on a line somewhere, that he really emphasizes the important role of education. And he's not blind to the fact that this system, if he even thinks of it as a system, he's not blind to the human potential human cost, I guess. So talk about how Smith does have his eyes opened to the needs of workers and the essential nature of education in particular.
Yeah. So the heart of economics comes from the very first paragraph in his political economy, which has to do with the specialization of labor. And he uses the example of the making of a pin. Mm-hmm. He says, one person, a pin that takes 10 steps to make. We're talking about a little pin, takes 10 steps.
Yep.
Maybe it's 12, maybe it's 15. I forget what the number is. But he says, now one person could maybe make 5 of those a day because they got to become a master at each of these 15 steps. But he says, now if you get one worker, for that becomes master at each one of these steps, right? Assembly line philosophy, right? He says, then you can, and I think he had a number, 48,000 pins, you know? And so I don't know if he actually toured the pin factory, but that's certainly where the illusion came from, right? That's what he said. And so you have more and more labor associated with the increased levels of capital. So the whole point of the growing system, that's the macro economy, is to assemble more and more capital, because then you can put more labor to that capital, right? And so people then in assembly line fashion can be highly productive and efficient, and the economy grows. And that's what he says on page 12 after the frontiswork piece of the Wealth of Nations. And then on page 792.
Yeah, it's a big book.
where he's in book 5 and the three functions of government. That's defense, and it's education, and it's other stuff. He says, oh, by the way, remember what I said 770 years ago? He says, well, here's the thing. This is what it does to you. You know, and you're waiting for 780 pages with bated breath to see what's going to happen to these poor suckers who are just doing the same thing over and over, right, over and over and over and over again. Right? And I know exactly. I've never worked at General Motors, but I was raised in the town next to GM, the headquarters of GM of Canada, Oshawa, Ontario. And a lot of my fellow students dropped out at 16 and got a wonderful job on the assembly line at GM in Oshawa and made great money, highly unionized, wonderful.
One of my elders at my last church was a riveter on the assembly line at GM. And I said, I'm not going to complain about my job as a pastor.
Does that not induce, Kevin, I would think, a certain torpor of mind? I had to look that word up.
Yeah. And this particular elder was super well taught and, you know, like a philosopher. And I think he had lots of time in his head to try to make a job as a riveter on the assembly line. Just what you're saying. And Adam Smith, he gets to the very end and he says, oh, by the way, this is kind of a bad way.
You're not
to
a
live.
Good contributor to society. You cannot engage in conversations that require the least bit of intellectual maturity. You cannot even be a thinking militia. How can we expect you to defend our country when the torpor of your mind. And he says, you know, he uses all these wonderfully politically correct for the words. They become so stupid. Who's what saying? Yeah. The workers that I just said have to do what they're doing 770 or whatever pages ago. It's just hilarious. The torpor of mind. So we need to do something. And so we need to educate. Why is education important? Number one, for the religious fanatics, and I'm going to insert parenthetically, like he may have been thinking of the John Knoxians of the 18th century, right? The iconoclast, the fanatics. I love John Knox, by the way. And secondly, the people who are working, making pins and other stuff. They don't know how to think. So publicly funded education, I mean, I love it. Publicly funded education, I love it. But that's his prescription. And that's what's going to fix you, and you need to engage in that. And he says, we're not providing education for people who don't need. We're not subsidizing education, but there's public education to help people like this, fanatics and the torpor of the mind, you know, re-stimulate those IQ points if we can and get people to start thinking again.
So here's my last question. I wish we had time to go through even more Adam Smith. I don't know how many people want more Adam Smith, but this is great. What do you have, Jan? Maybe one or two lessons from Adam Smith. So just if a Christian is listening to this, what's a lesson from Adam Smith that we would do well to remember, an insight he had, an influence? So what's something good? And then is there something dangerous or something he missed in his philosophy as Christians that might be the air we breathe, but let's be thoughtful here. That doesn't quite pass muster with biblical faith. Can you give us one or two lessons, maybe one positive, one negative?
Yeah, I think on the positive, that there is so much that resonates with, I think, our Christian sensibility on flourishing, on how you treat humanity, and how you deal with wrong turns and dead ends, right, in human thinking and in the playing out of political economy. There's a lot of value here, really. It can't help, it seems to me, but be the case that, as I say in the article, there are sprinklings of his Calvinist orthodoxy somewhere.
I totally agree. Yeah.
You know, it has to be. I mean, in the last edition, he talks about justice. And in earlier editions, there was a large section on the substitutionary atonement that God provided to, you know, forgive those who, and so forth. But in the last version, he took that big out. A whole scholarship has arisen around that, reasons why I address some of that, and has it been to appease his mother, who he was waiting maybe that she'd die, and then he would really reveal his true faith? I don't know. I think his faith kind of unraveled, or just thinned out over time, but there are still, I think it's a good lesson in common grace, that we can learn a lot from other people, even though we don't see the same in terms of faith. I mean, it's amazing the system he set up for the social construction of individuals, right? To create a wonderful society, a flourishing society, and then not to have a foundational basis for it.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is the danger.
Yeah.
The danger. I mean, I don't know. So in that last edition, he took out the substitutionary atonement and said, because in the end, everybody in the hereafter will go to either a place of a happy place or a sad place. And he's got the Greek or words, I think, for that. I forget what they are, but So I think that's both I was really helped by it, in terms of how people think, how people, and the important, you know, Stoicism and Christianity, they have a lot in common too. You know, yeah. The Stoics were no fools, right? But the center of Christianity, I think, is the cross. It's Jesus, right? And it's our theological anthropology, right? And the anthropological centering of Adam Smith's work, I think, is dangerous.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
The theocentric center of what, for example, Bob Gautzwar talks about flourishing, what constitutes a good flourishing society. You know, he talks about the idols of our time. That's something we can get from Smith too. What are the idols? Well, he doesn't really identify them, but we need that Stoic self-command and real heavy doses of it to subdue our own passions, right? Our desire for material wealth. That's the culture we live in today. You know, crazy capitalism. You know, he was so protective of the poor, of those who were taken advantage of by the merchants, the whole concept of mercantilism, right? He was so aghast at it because it enriched everybody's pockets. There was entrenched privilege everywhere except for the poor, right? Mm-hmm. And so he has a passion for the poor. And I think we would do well to learn from that and for the dispossessed and, you know, the those on the fringes, the non-seen people in society. But a better take on this, I think, is the Kuyperian or neo-Kuyperian, neo-Calvinistic way of dealing with the true humanity of people by pointing them to Christ, what Christ has done, and what true globalization will be. It's not going to be the economic and social globalization we have. It'll be the globalization of Jesus Christ. And that's what, and Gautzwart is also picking up from Bonhoeffer, who talks about, you know, we need to look at things from the end, not from the beginning, and then work backwards just to bring about that desired and that flourishing of humanity to the glory of God, and that's what the summum bonum is for the Reformed Christian, is the consummated kingdom of God, not some nice, happy society where people are happy because we're all doing well. I mean, that helps, sure. But it's so much deeper than that. Somehow,
yeah, that's right.
Smith kind of knew that, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's a system in its best parts that's built on a foundation that he probably didn't even realize was there and didn't want to articulate. And the anthropological system itself is always going to be inherently unstable.
It is.
You've done a really admirable job summing up what are good things, and I appreciate in this series and in your book, Jan, that we should read these. I mean, it's one of the on any short list of most important thinkers in the last 300 years, especially in these fields related to economics and moral philosophy and sociology. Adam Smith is going to be on that list, and in 150 pages, you've given a great introduction and then some. So thank you for this book put out by PNR in 2024, talking with Jan Van Vliet from Dort University in beautiful Sioux Center, Iowa. So thank you for being with us on Life and Books and Everything.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. Yep. Thank you.
And thanks to all of our listeners. You can get more episodes like this and lots of other resources at clearlyreformed.org. Until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.